You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Got your hand on your heart there? Little history now. The rise of the nation-state created the modern world. Nations supplanted feudal kingdoms and city-states, and the political world we know today has been pretty much intact for the past century. Just listen. Well, that last anthem is familiar. Can you name the others? Italy, France, Russia, and China? There are numerous indications, despite the pleasantness of those national anthems, that this system of nation-states may be unraveling. With pressures from within and without, nation-states are being challenged by the rise of transnational corporations, the impromptu congregations of online populations who have successfully toppled governments in the Middle East and elsewhere. And there's the growing realization that single nations in a world of 7 billion people might not be able to accomplish very much on their own. The emergence of new alliances and cooperative arrangements from the EU to the G20 and the G7 industrialized nations, the BRIC nations, can you name them? Brazil, Russia, India, China. All of these groupings would have been unthinkable a generation ago, but they are everywhere today. Joining us now is Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group and author of Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G0 World. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here on Takeaway.
So I saw you nodding at those national anthems. You know these flags.
Sure.
And the G0 world, describe what that is and how it sort of, in a sense, describes this narrative of the challenges to the nation state right now.
Well, let me describe a visual since we're on radio.
Yes, you look
at the cover of the book and you have a big circular table with all of those flags that you're talking about and a whole bunch of seats that normally you'd have representatives from those countries actually sitting at. But on my table, they're empty. And they're empty because there isn't a willingness to talk about, provide global leadership, and our global institutions don't function anymore.
So we're in a transitional state where no individual nation can serve the purpose of the superpowers of the Cold War, and the U.S.'s influence is waning in this. Yet we don't have institutions that globally can enforce the kind of cooperative arrangements that we really, really need to make the economy work better and to deal with issues like global warming, to just name an obvious one.
Well, I mean, you look at what's happened in Europe. We've had this extraordinary fiscal crisis that's really wrenched the Eurozone for the last 2 years. And Geithner is more than happy to get on a plane and dispense advice, but he's not going to write any checks.
Right.
And when Sarkozy went to the Chinese and said, hey, you know, can you help us out? The Chinese said, well, no, they're not either. No individual country, no combination of countries. If the Europeans are going to get through this, they're going to get through it themselves. It's not like the peso crisis or the Russian ruble crisis or the Asian crises in the past. And the same thing can be said, as you mentioned, of climate, of trade, of Syria, of Iran. People aren't asking me if the Americans are going to bomb Iran. They're asking if the Israelis
right.
are, precisely because of this G0.
You know, that's what's so interesting about this book, and you write about it. These arrangements that are being made sort of impromptu, ad hoc, to deal with financial crises in Europe and elsewhere, the U.S. problems with its own debt going to China, these don't have the grand quality of, say, the Marshall Plan. These aren't strategic alliances. These are little business deals that vanish almost the moment the leaders leave town.
That's the funny thing, is there's been such an extraordinary debate in the United States about whether or not the U.S. is in decline. And it seems to me a little narcissistic and not to the point, because whether or not you happen to think the U.S. is in decline, there is not a political leader alive today in the United States that is remotely prepared to talk about a Marshall Plan for Europe. That's not remotely on the agenda, and neither would the U.S. be talking about setting the standard for a global deal on climate. We had Copenhagen. We're done with all of that. It's not remotely on the agenda today. So you're right. These are very tactical business deals, and they tend to happen later as opposed to earlier, only when things get sufficiently bad that somebody has to do something to kick the can a little bit down the road.
So you're describing a scenario here that seems to me very reminiscent of 100 years ago, pre-World War I, where there was this sense that globalization or global cooperation, in Europe particularly, was ending this period of all these nations for themselves. And what we discovered, of course, is that the Great War just reinvigorated all of that and meant that those destructive tendencies were certainly there and defined pretty much the 20th century. Now we're in a similar moment where globalization, in theory, allows us to have much more cooperative arrangements and encourages us, in fact, to do things cooperatively. Yet, you say, politically, the dynamic is forcing all these states back into their own little bunker. And that seems to me pretty startling, frightening, and destabilizing for the world moving forward.
It depends where you look in the world. That's where it's different from before World War I. Because if you look at Europe itself, actually, the level of crisis is compelling them with already a level of political and economic integration to try to get governance right. And you see that certainly in Italy, but you see it in terms of the level of German cooperation in creating governance with core European states and with the periphery. And over time, I suspect they'll end up in a slightly better situation than they were when all of this hit. But in the Middle East, of course, what's happening is precisely what you described. Absent being part of a more global system, you're seeing fragmentation, you're seeing sectarianism, you're seeing local powers like Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey playing a much greater role, but with completely zero-sum aspirations for who's a winner and who's a loser, and that's causing more conflict. Every country in the Middle East right now has a worse trajectory than it did before since the Arab Spring, with the possible exception of tiny Tunisia. And the big question, of course, is what's going to play out on the big global stage between the United States and China? What's going to play out in Asia? And that's still a very open question.
Depending on how that plays out, and spin out some scenarios, if you would, over the course of the next several decades, a U.S. and China scenario that benefits the rest of the world, or a U.S. and China scenario that really leaves the rest of the world behind? Which do you think is going to happen?
Well, I'm glad you said the next couple decades, because the next few years, U.S.-China relations are likely to get more challenging, in part because the Americans are more constrained by their own domestic population and how much they're willing to do internationally, and the Chinese are more constrained by just keeping it all together, and as a consequence, really disregarding what the demands may be from the United States and other countries because their domestic constituency is putting them in such a box. Over the longer term, the question is really going to be, will the Chinese fundamentally restructure their political and economic system, as they must, to move towards a consumption-led economy? If they're successful in doing that, and we just don't know. I mean, an economy, an authoritarian economy of 1.3 billion people has never even tried that before, never mind tried and actually been successful. But if they can do that, then domestically you will end up with Chinese that have the same aspirations and demands in the long term for rule of law and intellectual property and contract viability and all of these things that would help to make China a member, a responsible stakeholder, as we like to say in the United States, among a bunch of other countries that have reasonable international governance. But if that doesn't happen, then we have a very serious problem.
Mm-hmm. But if that stakeholder does join the world community, it would have the effect, at least in the near term, of raising all ships, because the prosperity of China would be something that would benefit the rest of the world, assuming rule of law and these sort of cooperative arrangements actually come into being. So let's think about the end of the 21st century. What will nation states be? Will they be no more? Will these flags be relics in museums? Or will they just be relatively unimportant and there will be a different set of institutions that you try to envision in this book that to govern the world?
Well, we don't do centuries anymore, of course. And so the notion that it's an American century or Chinese century, the world just moves too quickly. One thing we do know is decentralization and fragmentation is something we've seen in the nation-state system for well over 100 years now, and we will continue to, at least for the foreseeable future. So there'll be a lot more states, right, that will come as individuals that are empowered with communication technologies and information-seeking technologies will be able to find themselves more sustainable in small groups. And that's not just in terms of ethnic fragmentation. It's also a slum that's vibrant and large, but just doesn't get anything from its government anymore. And so they increasingly just slip off the grid.
And you're seeing that in Brazil. You're seeing that in Nigeria. You're seeing that places all over the world.
You absolutely are.
Yes. Ian Bremmer is president of the Eurasia Group, author author of Every Nation for Itself, Winners and Losers in a G-Zero World. Thanks for coming to the studio.
My pleasure.
You can see more on that story at thetakeaway.org, and we've also been talking this hour about Facebook's decision to list organ donor status on Facebook profiles. Could be groundbreaking. Some people think it could be TMI, too much information. Here's a listener who won't just stop donating his organs. He's talking about donating his whole body.
A lot of people should choose the option of donating their body to science, which is my choice. I think that maybe one day we'll be able to find the key to not having to worry about finding organs to donate. We may be able to make or grow our own.
And you should look at his status page on Facebook. We want to hear your stories. Will you list your organ donor status on Facebook? Have you donated an organ? Tell us your story at 877-8-MINDTAKER or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Huckenberry. Celeste is on assignment in Detroit, and we'll be broadcasting from WDET in Detroit tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.